Evening.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Okay. We had stopped on page 124 in the chapter on Christian struggle, I believe, week before last, and I had divided the chapter up into five sections so that we could read through highlighted portions and then discuss each one. I'm going to do the same thing for chapter 11 coming up. You couldn't just pick out a few things. It's just too good. So we're at the fourth of those 5 points. It begins the second to the last paragraph on 124. True, we must not think that man is in a condition to save himself solely through his own efforts. Anybody who believes that is not a Christian. It's not true. We cannot save ourselves through our own efforts. Or that these efforts are merits before God. That is also, as far as we're concerned, heretical, and it was a very popular heresy in the West, with indulgences based on the merits of saints that were building up in a treasury in heaven, and you could draw on those merits by making a donation and help people in purgatory. That also is heretical. So there's one that the West traditionally accused the Eastern Orthodox of, which we never taught, that we could save ourselves, and one that, as far as we're concerned, definitely was taught in the West. Neither one of them is the case. But, last paragraph, this labor and effort are impossible without constant self-restraint, without constant exertion of one's will, without a persistent battle with the base meaning what? Low, beneath the dignity of a human being, with a persistent battle with the base, egotistical strivings of one's sinful nature. Sometimes we feel like I am exceptionally bad like this, you know, that everyone can see, and or that I'm, you know, revealing in confession that I am uniquely like this. But no, there is nobody's uniquely like this. We're all like this. It's the same for all of us. We have egotistical strivings of our sinful nature. So we all have to engage in this spiritual struggle, this Christian battle, this Christian struggle. A battle arises in the soul between good strivings, striving after good, not accomplishing it, not being ever able to be good ourselves and perfect, but it's striving. Striving is necessary. A battle between good strivings and bad habits. We definitely can build up habits that make us less able to engage in a free choice to strive toward what is good and noble and pure. The more we exercise self-restraint, the more our bad habits weaken. So if we exercise self-restraint, our habits will weaken. If we keep giving in, our habits strengthen. And the easier it becomes after this self-restraint or continuing self-restraint, the easier it becomes to overcome them. It requires that man constantly restrain himself to do not what the sin living in his flesh desires, but that which the law of God, the law of good, demands. Without this constant self-restraint, there can be no success in the spiritual life. An ascetic is a person who forces himself to do that which is conducive, that which is encourages, and not just encourages, but gradually strengthens the growth and development of the spiritual life. He loves God and one's neighbor, and refrains from everything that is contrary to love for God and one's neighbor, that is, evil deeds. So that's the fourth section. There's one more to the end of the chapter. So what do people think? Is this something, a struggle that we're familiar with, or maybe a struggle that maybe we're not as familiar with as we ought to be? You know, the easy way out is to just feel like we're being humble as we can be, to confess our sins and to admit that we do the things that we do and we reject them. But the struggle has got to be intentional. When we leave confession, we're told, go now and sin no more. And after that comes struggle, not overnight perfection, but struggle. So what do you think about this section? Necessity for ascetic struggle.
I know for me, thing, the thing that you said about the butterflies and everything, and Sir Paul and everything. I know a lot of what goes on with me is I don't seem to just simply shoo them away, but I get all caught up.
Thoughts.
I get caught up in my thoughts. So. Yeah, I get caught up in my thoughts, and I get caught up in trying to battle them with logic and this and that, you know. Mm-hmm.
And then if you do that, then you're already involved with them.
Right.
Yeah. Now, if it involves looking at something, for me, a principle is, and this can become habitual, a principle is to discipline ourselves to look away. It's just look away without making a public spectacle of it, you know, making it real obvious, you know, publicly letting people know that we're looking away. You know, there's kind of pride and condemnation involved in that, but it's always possible to look, even without turning your head, look down, look to the side, don't look at it, whatever it is. If it's something that we see that's tempting. But there's something I think that is just the same as that when it comes to these thoughts. Because they will pass. They will pass. Unless we could be kind of outraged or disappointed or upset because they even come into our mind and then we start to engage in them. We're doing more there than if we just turned our mind's eye, more or less, away from those thoughts. And they'll pass. Unless we engage them in some way, they'll pass. That's the easiest thing to do, I think, and it is possible to make that a habit, you know, to make that habitual. And I've often mentioned to people, in fact, I mentioned when I was explaining this to Sharon, we were talking about it this afternoon, she's not doing real well right now. She's having a lot of pain. She has a lot of pain in her foot and her knee. And the more she tries to do, the more pain she has. So she just couldn't face an evening of making things worse, so she's not here. But we were talking about this, and I mentioned something that has happened to me is that once it becomes habitual to avert our gaze, to not look, there is something in the back of my mind, when I think of they talk about the oldest part of the brain that's always out trying to get and to dominate and to conquer. There's that part of the brain that's like that. And I have felt on occasion a kind of twinge from that part of my mind or consciousness condemning me for, why did you miss that great opportunity? There are always thoughts coming and that sort of thing, but we can make it habitual to not engage in whatever thought. When we recognize a thought that is a problem, we can look in another direction.
I even took the time to memorize one of the 55 maxims that Father Thomas Hopko, where he says, do not engage intrusive thoughts and feelings. Cut them off at the start.
Right, you know? Right. And it doesn't even necessarily involve a strong act of will where it becomes a contest of will. That's my point. It's possible to just
cultivate it.
Look away, visually or mentally. And if that becomes habitual, it really takes care of a lot of stuff. It's not that other stuff won't come that is more difficult. It will. But it takes care of a lot of things that can occupy us. Okay, anything else?
It reminds me of when a certain person was walking on the water with Jesus and he looked away and then started
Peter.
Seeing.
Yeah.
Peter.
Yeah.
He's the same one who touched the wounds.
Well, in this case, looking away from Christ, not focusing, not paying attention to him. And so in that case, looking away, becoming more aware of what am I doing? Well, that's your mistake. You know, in the first place, it's not you doing it all by yourself. And as soon as he becomes more aware of himself and less focused on Christ, he begins to sink. So the similarity, I think, is that in both cases, we do have a choice. We can focus on Christ and not sink. We can look away from some tempting thing that we see. Or do we have the thought that, you know, I think I'm going to go and look at this kind of stuff? We can turn our thought away from that. So we turn our thoughts away from things that we ought not to look at. But when it comes to Christ, you know, he is the one that we need to focus on. So the common element there, I think, is our freedom in both cases to do one or the other. Peter didn't have to lose his focus on Christ. He could have chosen not to. And Jesus, you know, talked about him, you know, not having faith. So I think by bringing up that example, the focus is on the fact that we have a choice. You know, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Okay. Okay, the next section then, last section in this chapter. Thus we can see that a constant battle of good with evil takes place in the soul of an ascetic. Now, if we're not making any spiritual effort, then we are not ascetics. We're not making any kind of ascetic effort. We can make an ascetic effort without being a monastic, you know, making it our central way of life. All Christians, Archbishop of Erki says, should have some experience of ascetic effort. All Christians should have experience of prayer. You know, all Christians should have experience of coming to the Vespers and Divine Liturgy and the Feast of the Church. I mean, we don't do it on the kind of constant, all-consuming way that monastics would do, but we all need to do it to a certain degree, and this includes making an ascetic effort and taking up a battle against evil within ourselves. If we don't, how can we say that we're Christians? Christ has made it possible for us to do something that we're not involved with doing at all. This battle, Archbishop of Erki says, constitutes the very essence of spiritual life. Spiritual life is about this battle. There's no way that we can think of spiritual life in some other kind of way that doesn't involve good strivings, self-restraint. If we have no self-restraint and no spiritual struggle, then we have no spiritual life, because spiritual life is active. We can't make it into a kind of legal system where we set it up so that, well, we live in the world, we do something bad, we go to confession, we confess it, and then we go back, and then we go to communion, and then we go live in the world, and we live the same way as we did before, and when we do something bad, we go back to confession, but we never make any effort. That's not spiritual life. We've come up with a system whereby we don't have to make any spiritual effort, and, you know, God sees it and he knows we have no love for him. We have no love for our neighbor. There's just no way to avoid the fact that making spiritual effort is part of Christian life. Asceticism is the one sure path to the alluring lighthouse of happiness which all people seek. Everyone is pursuing happiness. You know, we have the right to pursue happiness in our constitution. Happiness is not outside of a man. 9 times out of 10, that's where people look for it, outside of themselves. Things of the world, being well known, having people think really highly of us. But happiness is not outside of a man, but inside of a man. Happiness lies in a peaceful state of soul, in serenity and internal calm, which come from internal satisfaction following victory over evil and the eradication of bad habits that tyrannize the soul. Sinful habits create chaos and disarray within us. Evil inclinations, in being inclined toward evil, cannot be peaceful, calm, and joyful. The only way to pacify, to make peaceful the soul, is by suppressing and eradicating bad habits through asceticism, an ascetic way of life, a life of spiritual effort. And last page, 126, asceticism is absolutely necessary for all people, without exception. It is a common good, a common heritage, the heritage of the spiritual guidance. The Philokalia and other spiritual writings is our common heritage. It's not just for monks. One who is a stranger to spiritual effort, to asceticism, is his own enemy. You're constantly at war within yourself, and deprives himself of a higher good, peace, a tranquil conscience, and a joy in union with God, who is the one source of true happiness for man. So, has he convinced us that Christian struggle, spiritual struggle, is something that is possible and practical for all of us? He's been doing his best to do that. What do you think?
If you're going to get in, you got to get all the way in.
Well, yeah, at least make a significant effort, a serious effort, yeah. And know what it is. And, you know, I mean, like Pascha, we experience Pascha and we remember it. We say every Sunday is a little Pascha. We don't experience the brightness of Pascha every Sunday. Maybe it's possible, but we don't. But having had the experience of Pascha, having had the experience of having made spiritual effort, we can always return to it. You know, if we never make the effort, we're encouraged to make spiritual effort during the fasting seasons, you know, that we're in one right now. We're not told, okay, Orthodox Christians, ascetic effort is necessary. You become an Orthodox Christian. Here it is. No meat, no dairy. That's it. Live on vegetables the rest of your life. Make an ascetic effort. We don't do that. We do it periodically. And mainly, we do it together. You know, whenever someone comes up with the idea that, you know, this is not during Lent or not during Advent fast before the celebration of the birth of Christ, I am going to really make this spiritual effort, and there's an isolated effort made on the part of a person all by himself or all by herself. When somebody tells me that, and I've heard it periodically, it always worries me, because this is not something that you can undertake alone. And, okay, we'll say, well, me and God, we're going to do it. Nobody else is doing it, but we're going to do it. Well, you could say, okay, you want to make that kind of effort? Realize that there are monasteries. Men and women are making that kind of effort. Understand that you are making this effort along with them. But get rid of the idea that this is something that I am going to do. That's never, never a good idea, even during Advent or Great Lent. One of the reasons that I was so enthusiastic over that report on distractions is Sharon and I just came back from a week at Edisto. And I have to admit, I wasn't too enthusiastic about going. Because, oh, hey, it's a fasting period. People want to what? Take a vacation? Go to the beach? And I wasn't. I wasn't too positive about it. I was kind of along for the ride. Our son Jesse and his wife have a garden gnome, one of those little guys with a red hat. And they take this garden gnome along with them when they go on vacation. And they have lots of pictures of him. You may have seen him on Facebook. They'll put him in the surf, you know, and there's their gnome, you know, going in. They went to the Grand Canyon, and there's a picture of him next to the Grand Canyon. Wherever they go, they take him, you know, and they put him in the car and take a picture of him. And I told Sharon, and maybe some other people too, you know, I feel like I'm the garden gnome on this trip. You know, I'm just kind of along for the ride, you know, and just it's not really something I want to do. But I tell you, after the fact, I really have to say, and this is largely because of the fact that we didn't have Wi-Fi, no internet for a week. I couldn't go online. I sent out a few emails because I had to make contact with people, and I had to drive down to where there was a bookstore and sit outside and get Wi-Fi from them. And otherwise, there were some things that I had to take care of. So a couple, three times, I did do that for a few minutes. But no Wi-Fi, none. I did a lot of reading. I finished the book. I had only gotten into it barely. Layman in the Desert. Knocked it right off. Great little book on prayer. We probably want to take a look at it for a possibility for our next book. Knocked it right off. And another book. Three books in a week and started a fourth one. So it was a retreat. It was more of a retreat than the retreats that I've been on with my brother clergy, I have to admit, because we always get involved in parish business and deanery business and diocesan business, and aren't we ever going to get a bishop and all. You know, it's not so much of a retreat, but this really was a retreat. Sharon said sometimes all four of us sitting in the room, in the living room, reading books, it looked like a library. It really was a retreat. And then with the Thanksgiving dinner, we had salmon, so we had fish and we had crab, but it was the most low-key Thanksgiving in memory. And I'm thinking maybe this is not such a bad thing, but to make sure you don't have Wi-Fi, you know, no internet, you know, for a week, that was really important. So it ended up working out really well. I don't think it was non-ascetic to walk on the beach.
No,
you know,
no.
I thought that was fine. It was contemplative. It was meditative. So I ended up being very positive toward it. And few distractions. That's the thing. Few distractions. It turned out being a pretty good trip. One of the first things he says in this article, this is from the New York Times article, it's online, about four paragraphs in. The net is designed to be an interruption system, a machine geared to dividing attention. We willingly accept the loss of concentration and focus, the division of our attention, and the fragmentation of our thoughts in return for the wealth of diverting information we receive. That's it. That's what it does. And it's worse now than it was 5 years ago, 6, 7 years ago. The internet wasn't as bad that way as it is now. I'm positive. 8 years ago, especially I can think back 8 years ago, you didn't have all these pop-up things. No. You don't have all this stuff around the side everywhere. The more commercialized it's become, the more it's become this way. So cutting yourself off from the internet for a week, we talk about television, and then we keep going online, and some of us have to. It's our work. But focusing on anything on the internet is just about impossible. Yes, it is a good source of information. I go, I get articles, but I'm telling you, they always talk about the difference between a man and a woman when they go to the mall. Malls are kind of passé now, old hat. But women, and maybe this isn't good to make this contrast, but women, they used to say, forage. They go and they see what's out there, what's good. They're gatherers. Men have a tendency to be hunters. Mm-hmm. Who wants to go to the store when you don't know what you want? The object is go, find what you want, and leave. Not go wandering around just to see if there might be something. So we'll see if there's, maybe there's berries, maybe there's, and you have to do that on the internet. It will suck you in. It's hard to even remember why you went on the internet sometimes. Maybe you need to write it down. You know, I'm here to find this, and get it, and leave. That's a hunt. Just like the mall, you know, or a department store. It seems to me.
I think Jude has a question about something you said.
Okay.
Is it just like when you go hunting, you hunt for an animal, and then once you're done with the animal, you bring it back?
Sure.
That's it.
Okay.
Sure.
I remember when I was Jude's age in school, and it reminded me of the wanting to be distracted. The kid would say, look, a distraction.
Right.
No, yeah.
And I'd look.
Yeah.
Every time.
Mm-hmm. How long does it take for you to forget why you're even there? You know, or what you were supposed to, what you were doing?
Not very long.
He still does it in college.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Chapter 11, the Holy Fathers on Combating the Passions. This chapter is a real present. You know, for us, I think. It's very focused, it's very concentrated. There's enough in here to fill lots of books. A lot of things that I've studied and reread about together in books much longer than this whole book are just laid out for us here pretty quickly. Okay, first section. All Christians are called into battle with the evil dispositions of their heart. Uncompromising. Don't compromise with evil dispositions. Evil dispositions. To be disposed towards something. What does that mean? I am disposed to...
What is it?
To consider it?
Like, consider it, yeah. I am, because dispositions, the root word, is to be disposed. To have a kind of a setup in your mind where there's a kind of a preference there. Already, I don't know, I'm disposed to respond to brown. I like brown. Brown's a nice color. I'm disposed to respond to, you know, these are like basic level things. Complex designs, when I see them, my attention is drawn to them. I'm disposed to, I don't know, I'm disposed to respond to girls like Sharon was in high school, you know, whatever that is. I mean, it's a particular type. Mm-hmm. You know, I have a disposition to gravitate toward, or I did, young ladies of that kind. Now I'm focused on Sharon, which is incidentally in the book, A Layman in the Desert, when he talks about chastity in married life. What he talks about is that chastity for a person who is married to a particular woman, chastity means being entirely devoted as far as your interest sexually, members of the opposite sex, you are focused on this particular woman. That's being chaste, that focus. But there is such a thing as a disposition. Now, this is something that's in our heart. We can have an evil disposition. We might have a disposition toward something in particular that tempts us. I'm not particularly disposed to sweets, which is good being diabetic, but I do have a disposition for fat, fried chicken, savory lamb, you know, well cooked and just that sort of thing, you know. Bubbly hot dogs all ready to chomp into.
Okay.
I have a, you know, it's a good thing to talk about this time of year, right? Yeah. So I have a disposition of that. It's not exactly evil, but it's good to be aware of whatever dispositions you have. And there are some things that are more tempting to us than others. And those are the things that we have to struggle with. It is from evil dispositions of the heart that arise and spread out, emanate, you know. All evil deeds come from these dispositions in the heart, things that are below the level of choice, where we are disposed to be tempted by particular things, you know. And it can lead to evil deeds, because we feel like, well, this is me, this is what I really want. Well, it may be that you have a disposition toward whatever that happens to be. It doesn't mean that you have to choose to fulfill that disposition. These evil dispositions of the heart are called passions in the writings of the Holy Fathers. To overcome and get rid of, to wipe out, eradicate, erase passions, evil dispositions is not enough. And there is a tradition, there was a tradition in ancient Rome of philosophers who were kind of spiritually minded philosophers, Stoics. Stoics made an effort never to be controlled by their passionate desires. And it's before Christianity. The Christians, when they talked to people who were Stoics, Stoic philosophers, thought it was a good thing that they were doing, because it was like the first step. You know, but it's not enough. And the problem is that it can be highly self-reliant, where you rely on your own will and your own strength of will and your own character. It may not have anything to do with God at all. So it's not just a matter of being able to not give in to passions, passionate desires. To overcome and eradicate passions is not enough. In the place of eliminated or eradicated or controlled passions that we don't give in to, it is necessary to firmly implant in the heart their opposite counterparts. The good dispositions of the soul that are called virtues by the Holy Fathers. Lots of times, especially if we grow up in the Western Christian tradition, and it's thou shalt not this, thou shalt not that, and there's a whole list of things that we ought not to do, and when we do them, we go and we confess, I did this, okay, what are you going to do about it? You have to work on the opposite virtue, otherwise you've just come and confessed in a kind of legal, I broke the rule kind of way. It's not just a matter of not breaking rules and then you'll be good. You'll be okay the way you should be. It's not a matter of that at all. It's a matter of confessing the fact that you chose to accept and act on some evil thought. And that's what you're confessing. And rather than doing that, the only way to avoid having it happen again is to focus on the opposite counterpart, the good disposition of the soul, the virtue. And there's a link right from here, right to the top of the next page, page 128. The soul of man cannot remain empty. If passions have been eradicated, then the opposing virtues must immediately be planted in their stead. Otherwise, the passions will return. And anything else would be a constant effort of your own will, which is not Christian spiritual effort. You know, it's not going to help. There are people who are trying to be Christians by doing that, you know, and it just is, that's not the way it works. The essence of asceticism consists of the eradication of passions and the planting in their place of the opposing virtues. There has to be both of those, not just one. Now, under a legalistic confession system, one would be fine because they don't believe that it is possible for you to make a spiritual effort where you are actively involved. But we do. We do. That was something that was lost in the West, in the Western churches. You know, no possibility of synergy, no possibility of cooperating with God. And anybody that says that they can make a spiritual effort and be better, then they would be accused in the Western tradition of believing that you can save yourself or you can get rid of your sins all by yourself. Well, that's not what we say. So this is the active spiritual effort in synergy with God that we're talking about. But we have to understand something about it. Even if we're not involved with it 24/7 like a monk, we have to be at least aware of these things, because this is the reality of spiritual life. In the middle of the page, the root and source of all the passions is egoism or self-love. Egoism or self-love gives rise to three principal passions, the three fundamental roots of all the other passions: love of pleasure, greed, and the love of glory, seeming good or great or important in the eyes of others. The love of glory, greed, and love of pleasure. Pleasure is not bad, but loving pleasure, it's not the highest good. Pleasure comes and goes, you know, but we can't make a life out of seeking pleasure, you know, because it just, life just kind of runs through our fingers if we do that. Same thing with the love of money is the root of all evil, it says in the Old Testament. It's not money. Money is neutral. But the love of money, greed, that's a problem. You know, to have that be a spiritual control for us. I'm going to jump down to the bottom paragraph here on page 128. From these three principal passions, in turn, come the following eight passions: gluttony, fornication, avarice, anger, sorrow, despair, vainglory, and pride. These eight passions lead to, or engender, or give rise to, or give birth to, yet more and more passions, which then branch out into many, and into a multitude of many different kinds, diverse and subtle variations of each of these passions. Okay, let's stop there. I have one more. Well, comment here in this section, but I think it's a good place to stop. Okay, so we got that straight, right? Love of pleasure, greed, love of glory, and these eight come out of those three. Any question about any of the passions or what's being said here? We're familiar with all those passions, right?
Yeah.
Gluttony, fornication, avarice, anger, sorrow, despair, vainglory, and pride. Top of 129, passions tyrannize and torment the human heart, never giving a person rest and causing him unbearable suffering, from which he loses spiritual peace, inner balance, and tranquility of conscience. The Holy Fathers studied all the subtleties of this age-old tragedy of the human heart afflicted with passions. They developed an entire science of fighting the passions, a kind of therapy, a therapeutic course for the ailing soul. This science is called asceticism. It is the necessary lifetime task for every Christian who recognizes the urgent necessity of the battle with evil. And there are a set of techniques that we can use in this battle. And I'll stop there. Are we following this? What do you think? We'll get to what we do instead in just a second. Nobody's in
You're going to take a stand in favor of these passions or anything?
No.
Oh, okay.
They're fun, though. I mean.
Well, as you know, pleasure comes and goes. And when it's here, you enjoy it. But it can't be the meaning of your life. One of the funny things that happens is if you make the gaining of pleasure the meaning of your life, you tend to get less of it in the long run. If you don't mess things up, it keeps coming around, you know, in its own time. It's like the change of seasons or good weather. Weather, I think, is the better example. I mean, there are rainy days and there are sunny days. Sunny days are more fun than rainy days, unless, like C.S. Lewis, you say, you enjoy weather. Lewis says that to live in England, you have to enjoy weather. That's how he looks at it. Yeah, and he means you have to be able to enjoy fog and sleet and rain and mist all the time and no sun and stuff. If you like that, you enjoy the weather. And then when the sun comes, hey, it's great, you know. So things change. Pleasurable things happen. You enjoy them when they're here, and you don't have to worry about them dominating your life because they will go away. You know, so it's not a problem, and unless you make the center of your life following those, trying to have more and more, then you get into a lot of trouble. One of the troubles you get into is that it seems to take more and more of whatever it is that you enjoyed to continue to make you be as pleased with whatever it was. You get too much of a good thing, and you say, "Well, I'm tired of it. I want a really good." Now I am no longer satisfied with the Kentucky Fried Chicken that I can get locally. Because if I want really good, actual Kentucky Fried Chicken, I have to go to Kentucky, to the original Kentucky Fried Chicken, because they are the only ones that do it right. So you're not satisfied with it. You know, it's not good enough for you. You have to have the best of whatever it is, and then you become a gourmet. So you don't have as much pleasure, because all these other inferior substitutions for whatever it is that you like so much that once gave you pleasure no longer give you any pleasure. Now you have to have the very best of whatever it is in order to get that same pleasure. That's how things are.
So being a gourmet is not good.
Well, I think, you know, it's a funny thing. I encouraged my children when they were young to think in terms of don't go for quantity, go for quality. You know, and which I thought was a good thing. I said, well, this will encourage them not to have too much of things that are okay, but are not good for you in great quantity. And, well, you know, they didn't all turn out to be gourmets, but one did. And it didn't work, my little trick, you know, because... So I'll probably cut that part out of the recording. Okay, principal techniques in this battle. First of all, we can take precautions ahead of time so as not to allow the passions to be conceived and take root in our hearts. I think the averting your gaze is a good example of that. That's a precautionary measure, something that you can train yourself to do. A passion that has already been firmly established in the heart and made a kind of second nature in man is very hard to battle. A lot of us have learned that is the case. I would be much thinner had I not learned that that's the case. To root out this second nature, this passion firmly established in the heart, and conquer it without God's grace-filled help is completely impossible. Therefore, it's necessary to keep vigilant and attentively watch one's own heart to not allow any passion to take root there in your heart to begin with, so that you won't have to fight this battle to get rid of one of these entrenched passions. And we can, you know, we may think, oh, well, there are certain things. I don't have the disposition to this particular passion. But we can learn new passions. We have to be careful about that. What are these precautionary measures? Top of 130. These measures consist in the constant and intensive mental battle with the thoughts. So, battle with the thoughts are precautionary measures. And he's going to explain to us, there are three stages in this battle with the thoughts. So this is really pretty deep into spiritual teaching here that he is at this point. First of all, initial suggestion. Second, acceptance of a suggestion in the mind. Third, consent. And fourth, captivity. And then fifth,
the passion itself. At that point, the passion is controlling us. At first, the conception appears in our mind, a person or a thing or some thought that suddenly comes to mind. This is called a suggestion. By itself, all in itself, a suggestion is not at all sinful. Thoughts are always passing through our mind. You know, we recognize that it's not something that is positive. We look away and it goes away. I don't know how you could, I mean, if you paid attention to all of the thoughts that pass through your mind, you'd be running after them all the time. You wouldn't be able to focus on anything. The internet problem that we're talking about, and it's not just the internet, is that it breaks down our ability to focus. The more our ability to focus is broken down, the more susceptible we're going to be to any thought that happens to go through our head. Follow this one, follow that one, follow the other one. Pretty soon we're all tangled up. Being able to focus on something is a great way to not find ourselves in that kind of condition. By itself, a suggestion is not at all sinful, for it is impossible for man to keep his mind free of thoughts. Thoughts arise in our minds apart from our will. That's why we're not responsible for the thoughts that come to our minds. Is this something that people have experienced, or is this these strange ideas?
No, it's like you said before, below choice.
Yeah, that's right. I've explained it to this way. I've explained it this way to people in confession sometimes, that there's always weather. You know, like we were saying before, there's always weather, and we have mental weather. Thoughts are, they're like weather. They're like breezes or storms or thunder or something. But just because there's a storm, it doesn't mean that we have to get hit on the head by a flying piece of tree or something. We can take shelter. We don't have to just stand out in the middle of the storm. You know, we can escape the storm. You know, it's the same thing inside of ourselves. We can take refuge away against the storm, let it pass by, not get into it. You know, when I was a young man, I enjoyed storms a lot. They're kind of fun. I remember being in Bainbridge, Maryland, and I missed Sharon. We had just started to go out seriously. You know, this girl I'd always liked in high school, and now I had a real chance with her. And it's just, I don't know, there's something about the passionate nature of a storm. It would just, you know, there would be a storm, and I would go down in the dock and just walk along the dock, and, you know, and watch the thunder and the lightning and smell the ozone and just get charged up, you know, with it. It's a dumb thing to do, you know, in a way, but it's kind of fun, you know. I loved it. And I would take a little bit of shelter under if I'd find a tree and just enjoy. I was enjoying the weather, but there was a link between my inner passions and the passion of the storm, you see. So, well, it's, you know, you can get caught up in that kind of thing. And that's what happens to us, I think, inside of ourselves. So instead of seeking shelter, trying to avoid the storm of some passion, we enjoy the passion. It's invigorating. It makes us feel powerful. And the irony is, we could get conked any time, you know, and that'd be the end of us. So we're not so powerful. But we have this affinity for natural power, I think. People have experienced this? No?
Probably, I guess. No.
Well, I have to go back a long time to feel that way because I generally get out of the rain these days.
Oh, yeah.
I don't go looking for thunder and lightning anymore. There's just not a lot of thunder and lightning in my blood, I guess. But, you know, at 17, 18, there's a lot of thunder in your blood, I think.
It seemed to come after me every once in a while.
I have no doubt.
One time I was out in the boat, and it was perfectly light. Dropped off my dad and my little sister. And then, before you know it, after the motor wouldn't start, got dark. A bunch of waves pushing me against where I was trying to paddle. A lot of rain. And lightning came. Another time I went down to a dock.
So you were you afraid?
Well, no, I wouldn't say that.
Yeah, see.
I was wondering if I was going to get out of it. But I went down to a dock another time in this storm. Just, This came up, and I was soaking wet. Did my duty in the dock and got back, but I was wet.
You have the great advantage when you're very young of being pretty sure nothing can happen. Nothing serious can really happen to you.
You think that when you're young, yeah.
It goes away. Otherwise, we'd all die. You know, you can't live like that, you know, permanently. Sooner or later, it would get every single one of us, I think, you know. So, like speed in a car, you know, or taking curves at a high speed and enjoying the thrill of the forces that are not going to do anything with you but throw you off the road or something like that, you know. That's a similar kind of situation. Okay. Yeah, you know about that. Okay. Thus, to guard oneself, second to last paragraph at the bottom, from this influx, from this coming into our minds of thoughts or different imaginings that appear in our mind, it's necessary to resist them and not let those that are bad or sinful, that lead one into sin, to remain and become entrenched, firmly built into life inside of ourselves. And now, at that point, we're talking about the second stage, about thoughts. So that if we don't avoid them, what happens? We accept them. They become, this sounds like a pretty good, you know, idea. Acceptance as entering into conversation with thoughts, dialogue, you know, not necessarily talking, but dialogue. And I would say that going out into the thunderstorm and feeling this link between the passions of my soul and the passions of the waves, you know, and because there's huge waves and sky and thunder, feeling that is like a dialogue between inner passions and a passionate state of the world outside. There's a dialogue. There can be a dialogue between ourselves as we think there is something about this that draws me. Whatever it is, it could be, well, you could go through the list. It could have to do with fornication, avarice, anger. I'm right to be angry, you know, that sort of thing. We really identify with it. We get off on it. It becomes a passion that we accept. That's a dialogue with this passion that arises within us, and we might attend to this passion as we would to a guest. An interesting guest. Kind of dangerous, but well, listen to this person. Listen to this passion. See where it takes me. This stage may be sinful, or it may not be sinful. How can that be? Top of 131. If, having directed our attention to the thought, we see that it is not good, but rather evil, and that it is leading us to sin, and we immediately take arms up against it and strive to promptly chase it out of our consciousness, then this second stage will be as sinless as the first stage. So, might be sinful, might not. But if, having examined the thought, we see that it is bad and sinful, but nevertheless we keep it in our consciousness, relish it, we enjoy it, and sympathize with it, we feel this similarity between our something in ourselves and this passion, then the third stage, consent, begins. And the third stage really is sinful. Consent is the willing acceptance of a thought that takes place when someone begins to imagine, to put into imaginary images in your mind about how it would be to act on the suggestions of the thought. I remember doing a lot of this in high school, especially at boring events that they would make you go into the gymnasium and you'd all sit on both sides and then have some kind of program on that down there that's just totally boring. And you go into this kind of reverie in your mind, you know, and just whatever you happen to be looking at, you just kind of build it into a kind of daydream imagination and images come up. And you could be deeply involved in some passion, right, that has nothing to do with what they're trying to display there as a entertainment, you know, which you're not interested in. And it happens to happen a lot. So I had a lot of experience like that. And still, a passion arises in the mind, and you want to, you know, kind of daydream about it, think about what it would be like, and kind of evaluate it, that sort of thing. So we have consented, a willing acceptance of a thought. We're involved with it. It takes place when someone begins to imagine and put into images in the mind what would you go about acting on the suggestions of this thought? How would you go about making it possible to have fulfillment of whatever imaginary desire has come into your mind? The soul at that point has become favorably disposed, although his conscience tells him that it is not good. That's part of what makes it exciting. That is, in fact, sinful. So, that's consent. That's the third stage. If someone is still inexperienced in spiritual warfare and is tempted by an evil thought, and then recognizing that it is sinful, even so drives it out, calling upon God for help, it is excusable. That's like a close call. So it's still possible to deal with it in that kind of way by calling out upon God. And it involves a repentance of having entertained or consented to this thought, having played with it. You reject it. The funny thing is that this seems to be exactly where most people start. Not with stage one or stage two, but before they know it, they're in stage three. They're tempted by it, they like it, they feel like, well, this is the way I am, I'm the kind of person who really likes this kind of thing. And by accepting that, you're accepting that you are going to be constantly at stage three. Never mind trying to avert your gaze, first stage, never mind never dialoguing with whatever it is, you're at third stage level all the time. And so temptations are impossible for you to resist practically. At that point, in that condition, you may, at a formal level, listen to the priest who says, well, when this happens, say the Jesus prayer. If that's the condition that you're in, chances of it doing any good, I mean, is it heartfelt? Are you really struggling? Is there a real rejection going on there? You've already consented before you got to this condition, and if you're in a stage three condition, that's a bad place to start out. You end up, you're risking giving in to any of these things that tempt you. When someone, though, conquered in thought, is determined in the root of his mind, in the depth of his heart, not to commit a sin or an iniquity indeed, this is the first type of consent. The second type of consent is when someone willingly accepts thoughts sent from the enemy and agrees and becomes friends with them. Fraternizes with them. For a fraternity, you have let's all get together into this group. Yeah, you know, you bad thoughts and me, we're alike. You know, we're in this little fraternity of enjoying whatever this is. That's why he uses the word fraternizing with one of these thoughts. And is conquered by them to such a degree that not only does he not resist the passion, but decides to do everything as it suggests. And then there's the feeling of, well, this is the way I am. It comes to me, it's a passion, I can't resist it. That's because we've already accepted it. We never did any kind of resisting in the beginning, you see? And the only reason he doesn't carry out the decision indeed is because he doesn't find the opportunity. The time or place or some other reason prevents him from carrying out his intention. So it's like Jimmy Carter years ago made the mistake, should never be. Never tell the truth in politics, it's a bad idea, you know. And, you know, he said that he had committed adultery many times in his heart. People thought, boy, what kind of a Christian are you? Well, he's an honest man, you know, to begin with. But if you have committed adultery in your heart and you're in this condition and you toy with the idea, there's only one thing missing, and that's the opportunity. Under the right circumstances, you're dead meat. That's that way with any kind of sin. It's not just that one that we picked as an example. So that's what he's talking about. There's been acceptance, there's been consent, and fraternizing with it, imagining what it would be like. The only thing that's lacking is opportunity. Once you reach that condition, this requires something to happen in holy confession that is called epitimia. Epitimia in Greek. Epitimia, footnote, is sometimes translated as penance. So you have to do something. Sometimes the priest, not in our society lately, because it doesn't work out, you know, very well in the way we are today. However, penance, epitimia, the Greek word, if you translate it as penance does not convey the proper orthodox meaning of the term epitimia. The word penance has something about it that has an understanding of payment for a transgression. Like if you've broken a rule, legal system, and now you should pay by having a penance. You pay for your crime, more or less. It's a crime, it's something you've broken the rule, now you need to do your time, you know, so we'll give you a penance because you're guilty. That's not what it means. That's not our tradition. It's not where way of understanding things. It won't change you. That's part of it. But epithemia is understood to be medicine, something that is taken in order to heal, to cure whatever is the problem, which heals one from the damage inflicted by the commission of the transgression. And so if you steal, if you can take it back, that's good. If you offend someone, you ask them for forgiveness. You do the opposite thing. So your epithemia is to do something that will heal the damage done by the sinful act, whatever it is. Okay. From this bad possibility, as far as the third stage is concerned, it's an easy transition to the fourth stage. So the third stage was what?
Accept it.
Consent.
Consent. And then the fourth stage is captivity. If a soul has accepted an evil thought and is completely gripped and carried away by it, this is called captivity. Captivity is the automatic attraction of our heart toward the thought or the constant allowance for it to dwell in ourselves that is uniting with it, which impairs our good disposition of our soul. There can be different degrees of captivity, and we should probably, I think that's a good place to stop. Any discussion about this or any questions, which I may or may not be able to answer.
What are the first two stages?
Okay, first of all, initial suggestion. Second, acceptance of a suggestion in the mind.
I thought that was three.
Consent is three. Third, consent. And fourth, captivity. And then fifth, the passion itself.
Actually doing it, I guess, is the last one. Acting.
Okay. Well, if we are captive, then there's a good chance we're, as it was said about the third stage, all that's lacking is the opportunity. If we're captive to it, then it's going to feel like, what could I do?
Yeah.
That's going to be our experience of it.
If the opportunity is there, you can get there with the suggestion. Sometimes.
Well, it depends on the disposition of your soul.
Yes, I think
so. So it would be more than just the suggestion. Okay. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
We'll pick up next time on page 132 with the different degrees of captivity. Okay, thank you.